The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Good evening, everyone. My name is Laura Kovacs, and I'm honored to introduce our guests this evening. Dan Berger is the author of the James A. Raleigh Prize-winning Captive Nation, Black Prison Organizing in the Civil Rights Era, a reevaluation of 20th century African-American activism through the prism of mass incarceration. He has also published op-eds and other work about critical race theory and social justice in a variety of newspapers, magazines, and scholarly journals. His new book, Stayed on Freedom, is a moving portrait of two people trying to make a life while working to make a better world. Alongside countless organizers and activists, Philadelphia's born and raised Michael Simmons has fought for social justice and human rights for more than 50 years, including more than two decades as a human rights organizer, both with the American Friends Service Committee and independently. This evening, they will be joined in conversation with Robert Salim Holbrook, Executive Director of the Abolitionist Law Center. Please join me in welcoming our guests to the Free Library.
Thank you, everyone, for that round of applause. I'm really honored to be up here on this stage interviewing you two. Dan, me and you go back from, you know, when I was incarcerated. I've always found your books profound. I've always found them not just insightful, but organizing tools. But after reading this one really, I would say, tops some all. So I have a question for you both. And Michael, you know, we're going to get to talking about you in your history and your family's history in a minute. I have a question about the title of the book, Stayed on Freedom. How did you come to that title, and then what does it mean to you both?
Yeah, thank you, and thank you all for being here. What a true honor to be back in Philadelphia and to be at the Free Library. The goal of the book and the point of the book is to really recognize that the struggle for social justice, struggle for liberation, is an ongoing one that involves many people over a long period of time across many geographies. And so often when we tell the story of social justice, we limit it to particular time periods or particular organizations, and we miss a lot of the dynamism. We miss the fact that some people who were part of one organization in one period were also trying something else in a different moment. And so this book is an attempt through two unheralded long-distance runners in the fight for social justice, Michael, who's here with us tonight, and his lifelong friend and comrade, ex-wife, and co-parent, Zahara Simmons, who I first met when I was 18, and we both started at the University of Florida at the same time. And so to me, right, Stayed on Freedom names that sense of ongoing commitment and ongoing experimentation that is required to make social change.
Yeah, well, that is how I view it also in terms of Stayed on Freedom is, you know, quite often people go through periods of activism, you know, particularly when they're young. And it happens a lot of times in the university and without. But then they move on and develop their lives and kind of stray away from social causes. And the thing that I'm most proud of, and I'm sure Zahar is too, is that we never left, that we considered our life one of struggling for human rights. And so that it took many forms, took many shapes, it took us places that we had no imagination of. In fact, I've been to places that I didn't even know about until I was in my 30s. So that Stayed on Freedom was an apt title for, I think, a chronicling of our lives. And I would like to just mention one thing. Because I'm from Philly, I was just telling someone that I went to elementary school not far from here, 26 and Thompson, a place called Robin Morris. And my mother, and we had a small library, and I can recall my eighth, third grade teacher coming up and saying that she needed to take me down here to get a library card. So I got my first library card here when I was 8 years old. So I just wouldn't say that.
You know, when I think of the title, the first thing that comes to mind is State on Freedom is a destination. It almost sounds like a compass. And reading the book, it sounds like that's what your life was about, staying on destination toward freedom, toward liberation. You know, a lot of people, when they write books, they name drop, right? But I'm just going to go through a few names in this book. Right? James Forman, Vincent Harden, Bob Moses, Fannie Lou Hamer, Ella Baker, John Lewis, Andrew Goodman, a martyr of the movement, Malcolm X, Muhammad Ahmed, Max Stanford, a lot of people don't know him as Muhammad Ahmed, you know, a giant, Ron Karenga, a Louis Farrakhan when he was Louis Walcott, right? You know, and I'm going to talk to you a little bit about that too, that nation history, because that's a history that I share as well. Could talk forever about all of these folks, but you are actually in space, in organizing space, in movement space. So for Philadelphia, right, Philadelphia is a city that a lot of people don't know. Max Stanford, RAM, what really, you know, was part, this city was like one of the major hubs of RAM. You talk about the black liberation culture in Philly. Can you just share with us a little bit about that organizing history in Philadelphia, particularly, and not to put your age out there, the pre, you know, black power movement, because we all know the Black Panthers in Philly. We all know the Black Unity Council, right? Well, not all of us, but a lot of us that are versed in that movement history, but we don't know a lot of the generational work that was going on 20 years before 1968. So can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, for me, it really is a convergence of things that in 1960, I was 15 and moving around the city trying to find things to read about African Americans. And go back in those days, there was nil. And I happened to look up on a bookstore in West Philadelphia at the time called the New World Bookstore. It was owned by a African American communist by the name of William Crawford. And when I met him, it was like a convergence of spirits. He was much older, and he would just sit me down and tell me about the organizing that had gone on, not just in Philadelphia, but in the Northeast. He talked about Paul Robeson, who he knew personally, W.B. Du Bois. He would give me books to read about African-American history, so that started me on a search. And from there, a couple years later, I met Muhammad Ahmed, who was known back then as Max Stanford, who was a founding member of the Revolutionary Action Movement. He started telling me about Marcus Garvey and just things that I had not learned in school, so that I began to be engaged in the organizing tradition of Philadelphia. And my first public demonstration was two blocks from where I was living at Sorbury Mansion, what is now high school, I guess, when Cecil B. Moore organized a protest demonstration attempting to get African Americans more jobs in the building trades. So that I was really young, inexperienced, didn't really know much, but was just seeking a way. And then the newspapers were talking about the Freedom Riders and the sit-ins, and I was just excited about it, but I had no way of knowing how to join it, but I knew that one day I would figure that out.
Thanks. And there's a funny story in your book where you talk about Muhammad Ahmed telling you about Marcus Garvey, and you was like, yeah, I gotta go fact check this. And I remember when I learned about Marcus Garvey and their membership was 5 million, I went back like, man, why ain't I hear about this in school? Let me go, and I read it and it blew my mind. Dan, you live in Philly. You know, you're a historian, a radical historian. What does Philly mean to radical social movements, radical protests, radical liberation movements, not just in the United States, but also from a spirit of internationalism to you?
Yeah, I mean, I love that we're all in conversation. You two are both as sort of children of Philadelphia. I lived here a while ago now, but I lived here for about almost 10 years. And I was really grateful to live here and not in New York or DC as places where people thought politics was happening, because I thought it gave a lot of space to actually do things or outside of the spotlight, but with a lot of creativity and imagination, and certainly the work of different abolitionist organizations that I was a part of, but also, you know, at every moment, I mean, Philly is proud of its history in terms of the revolution from Great Britain, but at every moment, particularly Black Philadelphia has histories of profound struggle that are blurring lines of religion and politics, that are sort of crossing sort of barriers of neighborhood, that are bringing, you know, Afro Boricua people together and sort of making worlds within the city of Philadelphia. And you know, the chapter about Michael's upbringing is sort of called World Making in Philadelphia, and it comes in part from a quote from Father Paul Washington of the Church of the Advocate, who said sort of Philadelphia had all the ingredients necessary to make a world. And I think that has, you know, looks differently in different moments of history, but is a continuity in Philadelphia. One thing, Philadelphia is a supporting actor in this book, right? It's a character in the book. It's a way station. You know, it was a way station on the Underground Railroad. It's an important part of abolitionist history, and it's a place where Michael and Zahara returned to or came back to at different moments, right? And I think that sense of Philly always being a sort of incubator of these politics is really important.
No doubt, no doubt. I have a question for you about your time in Atlanta. You organized with Project Atlanta, and it was SNCC's first entry into urban organizing, and was based on SNCC's organizing method of organizing around people's needs. And there's a section in there where you state that the maxim of organizing still held true: meet people where they are at. When you look at the contemporary Black liberation struggle, but also, you know, social movements, even in this age of, you know, like Instagram organizing, that's just like a totally different way of organizing, right? Do you think that maxim still applies today? Are movements actually meeting people where they're at, particularly within our communities? And I like to call them the non-gentrified areas. I ain't talking about the progressive areas of West Philly and these other areas where we're at. I'm talking about the Badlands. I'm talking about the real Black Bottom. I'm talking about everything west of 52nd Street, right? Are movements actually meeting people where they're at in those areas?
Well, to be honest, I'm not sure if I'm qualified to assess. I mean, that some of you out here know that I've been living outside the country for like 20 years, so I'm not as up to date on what the specifics of people doing. But I do know that there's certain things that transcend, as far as I'm concerned, transcends time, and that is organizing oppressed people. And I always tell people there's nothing harder than organizing oppressed people, because people find an accommodation with their oppression, and they can get through the day. And people might say, well, it's bad, but what you're saying could make it worse. And it's always true. It can make it worse. But, and my view is, as the lottery tells you, in order to win, you gotta be willing to lose. And that, like, I think that that people confuse mobilizing with organizing. And mobilizing has a role and is key, but it's not the goal. The goal is to change people's lives. And the goal is to have them change their lives. Because it's not, the issue is not me being a savior. It's me saying that you have the power to do that. And that is the catalyst that I think those of us who are organizers should be moving around. And that, so to that degree, I'm not sure how much organizing, frankly, is going on. I mean, I see the news on television, and I'm not in touch with people, but I'm convinced, particularly in Philadelphia, this is a strong tradition of neighborhood organizing. And that, like, I'm convinced that it's still going on. One of the issues that I think is, or things in terms of African Americans, is we have to organize virtually around every single thing in terms, I'm like a stop sign, so that our children can go across the street. The house that my parents lived in, that is on Huntington Street, and that and there's a school directly across the street. From 31st Street to 33rd Street, there's no stop sign, no light, no anything. So cars treated like a boulevard, and people can't even get bumpers in their street to slow these cars down. I drive by the University of Pennsylvania, and I can't go half a block without a speed bump. And so we have to almost be willing to die for things that people get that they don't even need. And I think so that as we get excited about things that generate mass movements, like the death of Melvin Floyd, the recent death of Tyree Nichols, that I think that, like, it's that day-to-day respecting the community, listening to their ideas, forming organizations is when we know that we've done organizing. And I agree, not in the gentrified, but.
Definitely. Dan, your thoughts on that? Definitely.
Well, I was going to say, I think, you know, you started that question talking about the Atlanta project of SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, and I think it might be worth talking a little bit about that and about what you and Zahara, who was the project director of the Atlanta Project, sort of confronted, right? Because this was, just for folks who don't know, you know, if you pick up nearly any book on the civil rights movement, and particularly any book on SNCC, Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, you will find only unkind things about the Atlanta Project. And so one thing that this book does differently is sort of take the Atlanta Project seriously as a part of SNCC, and really as the origins of Black Power, right? That's where Black Power grew out of the civil rights movement, out of SNCC, and the Atlanta Project was one of its primary incubators. But, you know, SNCC had been based primarily in rural areas in, you know, Mississippi most famously, but Michael worked in Arkansas, people worked in Southwest Georgia and elsewhere. But I think it would be worth hearing a little bit about, you know, the tenant strike, just the kind of conditions that you all found in Atlanta and how you worked to transform them.
Yes, you know, the thing about the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee was that the work was very reactive to the conditions that we were in. And Atlanta was, so that what became the Atlanta Project started out as an effort to support the election of Julian Bond, which is a story of struggling around opposing the war in Vietnam and the drafting of African American males. When we moved to Atlanta, we were just doing that and protesting the fact that an African American in Alabama had been killed for trying to use a bathroom. And the man shot him dead because he used the, quote, white bathroom. That in that context, as we were living in the community, we realized that we couldn't just live there without assessing it. I mean, Vine City was where we lived. The Omni has almost erased it, but it's still there. And and we began to realize that people had problems that we had to address. The housing was horrible, dilapidated. They barely, now this is Atlanta, Georgia, they barely had paved streets where we lived. People were working in the most menial jobs with the most menial pay. and that we began to organize. One, we organized tenant strikes, and because they were evicting people in the community. But again, when I say we organized tenant strikes, we talked to people about the need for tenant strikes, and so that they were the leaders. So we didn't speak for them. We created the, because of us, they were able to get media, but they organized in term with our support. Similarly, in terms of fighting for a higher wage in their respective jobs, that trying to improve the quality of the housing. So those were things that came out of our struggles in Atlanta with the community, and it was a much more complex struggle in an urban area than it was in a rural area, so that we had to deal with much larger factors, much more organized factors, much more complex factors in terms of the African-American community, so that that it was a success as far as we were able to go in terms of beginning to for people to begin to see that the civil rights movement was not just a rural Southern movement, but really was an urban, as much urban as it is rural.
And there's a good section in there where you talk about, even when it was about, and I'm not even going to say was, even when SNCC threw down for Julian Bond, it was not about electing Julian Bond. It was about building power within the community. So I really like that point, because oftentimes people confuse elections as destinations when it's actually building community power as a destination, and those elections are just expressions of that community power. I got a question to some of the organizations that you worked within. So, and this, I just really find this fascinating, that you went from SNCC to the NOI, which, I mean, I would love to just have that conversation, and then to the American Friends Service Committee. And for me, you know, when I was in prison, American Friends Service Committee was one of the most, like, a lot of people don't think of this Quaker organization as one of the most radical social organizations, but when I was in prison, they were the ones, when we were in the special management unit in solitary confinement, were sending us photocopies of the works of George Jackson, Huey Newton, Amilcar Cabral, because we couldn't have books. I met Bonnie Curris, I met Lutulu Ojori, the political prisoner out of Newark, right? Just enlighten me a little bit. How did you go from SNCC to the NOI? Because most people start off in the NOI, like me, and then because it's like a conservative organization, I was there for like 12 years, you kind of then move on to like a black power, you know, and the NOI is a black power. It's more about self-reliance. But I'm just interested in that transition there.
I was also interested in that transition.
Well, I mean, that's a long story,
The Nation of Islam.
So we were constantly on a search. I mean, we were constantly on a quest. We were looking for people with similar ideas. And quite often, in almost any organization that you're engaged in, unless you start it, there are parts of it that you don't necessarily agree with. And you try to assess the that which you agree, that which you don't. That when we left, we being Zahara and I, and I should add that, I mean, we are so sorry that Zahara Simmons could not be here, because she has a particular story that is much different than mine, in the sense that she grew up in the apartheid South and worked in Mississippi when unless you were white, nobody cared about you getting killed, and of course, she, being a woman and a project director at the time, Mississippi, one of the few, if any, female project directors in 1964. I mean, her story is one that is important to acknowledge, even though she's not here to tell it. But in terms of our common journey, that after we left the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, we were looking for organizations that thought we could relate to. And for a brief period, the Nation of Islam was one. And that it was very brief, and it was a dynamic experience, but we realized that was not for us, particularly for me in terms of the religious aspect, but also for Zahar, even though we respected the work that they were doing. Clearly, people of our generation and beyond were captivated by Malcolm X, and even though he had left at the time that we were there, but still, he was clearly a foundation for us. My experience is let me step back. That, like, I refused to go into the Army, and it's wound up doing 2.5 years in jail. And during that time in jail, the support that I and Zahar, we were still married at the time, had came from Quakers, and in particular, an American for Service Committee in general, that they would visit with conscientious objectors, but also other inmates, and I got to know them, some of them, very well, people that I hold dear to my heart to this day. And they, similar to you, one, just having someone to talk with from the outside, but two, in terms of providing books and materials and passing information along, so that, and the that there was a significant amount of the Quakers in jail with me, and in spite of, some people view the notion of nonviolence and pacifism as passive, but these were some, and these were dynamic people who used nonviolence as a way to challenge the administration, and we did many things in jail, not just individually, but collectively, not just as conscientious objectors, but as prisoners of the federal prison system that got really disrupted the management of the prison where we were at Allenwood.
No, and Teresa Schultz is in this room somewhere, unless she left, but I'm not. It's a well-known secret that the American Friends Service Committee in Philadelphia actually housed the Human Rights Coalition, an organization that we started inside of prison, and the Abolitionist Law Center actually was born out of the Human Rights Coalition. So those Quakers, those radical Quakers, have a long history of supporting radical prisoners on the inside. So I definitely want to lift them up.
Yeah, in fact, I like to say in that regard, I mean, that as an employee of the American Service Committee in the 70s, myself, along with some of my comrades from Seattle, Washington, and all, we were able to organize African-American workers in Texas, Arkansas, Oklahoma, Louisiana, around employment discrimination. As a result of my work with AFSC, we were able to be the vanguard of the divestment movement in terms of fighting against apartheid, that for the last 20 or so years, I've been working in Eastern Europe with people that most folks here in the U.S. know as gypsies. Their Roma is how they're categorized in Europe, or how they self-describe in Europe. So that all those experience came out of my relationship with Quakers, and I doubt if most of them would have occurred, frankly, had I not met both Quakers and the American Friends Service Committee. Yeah.
No doubt. Also, too, one thing about the Nation, it can provide some stability. When you look at, like, the organizing spaces on the radical left, and you see something like the Nation that has a very structured, you know, for a minute, it could definitely be something that you could cocoon yourself in. I want to talk about Zamora, because there is a section in here, Zahara, where that really struck me to a spirit of internationalism, and I definitely could see how it's related to growing up in the Jim Crow South, where in the mid-early 60s, she was involved in having SNCC raise awareness against South African apartheid. Now, this was a decade before Soweto, the Soweto riots. So, like, for people who don't know history, like, it was the 1976 riots in Soweto, South Africa, that really blew South Africa on the international stage. But here she was in the mid-60s, you know, organizing in the South, saying that not only should we condemn American segregation, but we need to be condemning South African apartheid, making that connection. For you, someone living in Europe now, how much did internationalism play a part in y'all journey, right? How much did, I would love to talk to you about the Southern Cone of Africa, why communism fell there, right? I'm sure that you could write a whole book on that, but how much did the spirit of Black liberation and internationalism, and also communism play a part into that? Like, let's name that, because that was like the underpinning of this spirit of internationalism that was flowing from the mid-site 1960s with the anti-colonial movements up until the collapse of the Eastern Bloc and Soviet Union.
Well, the thing about the African-American struggle is that if you look at it in terms of the mainstream media, it's really put into a very narrow political context. But if you look at African-American history, I mean, you see that even going back to Frederick Douglass, was talking about international issues, that W.B. Du Bois was one of the founding, what the founder of the Pan-African Conference movement that led to people like Kwame Nkrumah and Ezekwe of Nigeria, Jomo Kenyatta, in terms of fighting for African independence, and that Malcolm X was clearly, the last couple years of his life, traveled the world trying to get the UN to take up the issue of U.S. apartheid as an international human rights issue. William Worthy, a journalist who wrote for the Crises magazine, the magazine of the NAACP, was talking about Vietnam in the 50s, So that internationalism has always been an aspect of African-American struggle. The problem was, back in those days, is that the powers that be, even progressive forces, felt that African-Americans had no business commenting on it. When I talk about Julian Bond's election, what happened with Julian Bond was he had gotten elected because we had a campaign. SNCC, when I say we, had a campaign to get him elected. SNCC put out an not just an anti-Vietnam statement, but an anti-imperialist statement, if you will, when you look at the SNCC statement. And Julian Bond agreed with it. And because he wouldn't back down, they wouldn't allow him to take his seat in the Georgia State Legislature. And that if you go back and look at the media of the time when we gave our international statement, we were written off, not just by the media, but by other civil rights organizations. But it wasn't until Dr. King gave his speech in 1967 at the Riverside Church, where we got some credibility, but then they tried to write him off as a result of it. So that there's always been a struggle about African Americans speaking on foreign policy, particularly if we project an image and a policy that is counter to the contemporary one of any given period. Because by and large, African Americans don't support wars, don't support xenophobia, don't support racism, anti-Islamic behavior, so that it always puts us at odds with the powers that be.
Maybe I'll read a short excerpt that gets at some of this. Because I think one thing that the book does is sort of chronicle, how Michael and Zahara not only kept fighting, but kept asking questions, right? Kept asking new questions, kept expanding their sense of who they were and what their what their connections were in the world, right? And so, you know, their hearts and minds grow. And a lot of that was facilitated by travel, but also just being open to those connections and to those forms of struggle. And so there's a part toward the end of the book that that I'll read about Michael's work in with Roma that I think gets at some of this, including the significance of the sort of Black freedom struggle around the world. In December 1995, Michael brought groups of Roma activists into dialogue with African Americans to discuss civil rights organizing. The group of 20 gathered for 4 days in the Budapest suburb of, how do you pronounce that?
Szentendre.
We all come here as students and teachers, Michael said in opening the conference. Over the last few years, there have been a lot of Westerners who have come to this region solely as teachers. The spirit of this meeting is that we are here to learn from each other. While the African-American community has many organizing experiences, we too are in search of a movement. We are here to learn about each other, collectively and as individuals. The group shared stories to identify points of unity forged in difference as much as in commonality. The end of communism eviscerated the Roma workforce, much as deindustrialization and mass incarceration had done for Black youth in the United States. questions of assimilation and stereotypes, the unique pressures women of both groups faced, and whether to work within or from outside mainstream politics loomed large. "We know everything about each other, and we know nothing about each other," one of the Roma participants offered. "We know everything because the relevant issues are the same, but our civic movement is a new one. Yours is an old one." After a day of heady discussion, the group celebrated with a raucous party in a working-class Roma neighborhood. The alcohol flowed freely, a bit too freely, Michael thought, as he hid in the bathroom at one point to avoid someone's advances. He took it in stride, having been to his fair share of exuberant gatherings. The next day, the Roma at the meeting apologized. "It's no big deal," Michael reassured them. Still, they insisted on bringing the group to meet middle-class Roma. "We are not all like that," someone said of the previous night. But Michael saw it differently. "We are everything," he told them. "It's not this or that. It's this and that." When Roma pined for their equivalent of Martin Luther King, Michael tried to tell them, "You are Martin Luther King." There was no leader to save them. They needed a movement. "The process of liberation is as important as being liberated," he told them.
So now we're going to open up the floor for some questions. So,
pardon me, I'm a little low. But I come to tell you that. I come to hear exactly what you're saying and to inspire the next group to keep on struggling. This will never end without a struggle. I've been at the bulldozers. I've been at the schools. I've been at all of those struggles. It will never end. They're not going to give up easy. And if you don't fight, it's all over. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good evening, everyone. My name is Asantua Nkrumah Ture. This is a great panel, and I'm really happy to be here to see you again, Baba Michael, your daughter, Aisha, who I've known since before her film came out. This is really great. And shout out to Sister Zahora. My question is, and I can never thank you, Michael, and your generation enough. I've met several SNCC members, you know, my big brother Kwame Ture, met several Panther members over the years. But I can never thank you all enough for what you taught me about other people in struggle and international solidarity. In particular, you had some Japanese comrades as members of SNCC back in the day, one of which was Ed Nakatawazi, who lives here in Philadelphia. Is he here this evening? Is he not here? Is he not here? I learned a lot from him. We had a conversation a few years ago. Learned a lot from him. I also appreciate you all taking a courageous stand in solidarity with Palestine and being against Zionism. And now we have BDS growing all over the world. What's your reflection on how you built that international solidarity? And thank you again.
Well, you know, it varies from time to time. But one thing is we took advantage of students who were at various universities in the country. I mean, that virtually every university these days has international students, and while it wasn't as many perhaps when I was in school, but they were still international. So that was clearly one. I mean, the other is really to educate yourself. I mean, they really have to do some reading to find out what issues should be prominent in any particular struggle, and that always understand that solidarity is not leadership, that people will determine what they do. What I try to do is to make the space for them to make that determination, so that during the anti-apartheid struggle, for an example, there were various liberation movements. It wasn't just the ANC, there was the PAC, there was the Black Consciousness Movement, and people used to put pressure on me to say, you know, to pick. And I said, no. I mean, that within a political parameter, it's on them to choose who they want to lead. It's on me to make the space that allows them to make that choice. And that's how I see that solidarity.
Yeah, thanks so much for talking. I really enjoyed this book. I read it recently. And yeah, your life was so fascinating. It's such a great book that you put together too, so thank both of you. One thing that I thought was interesting was sort of the story you tell about kind of the transition from, you know, activists becoming, you know, workers for nonprofits in a way that sort of happened a lot in the 70s and 80s, I guess. And I wanted to ask you about that sort of transition for you, sort of becoming, you know, from being an activist to being, you know, someone who's is paid to be an activist, whose job is being an activist, and that sort of that transition. So, because I thought that was interesting.
Yeah, you know, it's not planned. You know, I mean, you know that, like, when you look back on things, it tends to look like, you know, you saw this and you saw that, and in fact, it's very pragmatic, very incremental, and you're responding to situations so that. In most of my employment life, my job was at administrative. I was never really, except for SNCC, I was, and we're talking about $10 a week in SNCC, by the way, but I was never paid to be an activist. But I know that that for me, I cannot just sit behind a desk and do that kind of work, which needs to be done, but I'm just saying that's not for me. So that in virtually every job that I ever had, or every role I ever played, I should say, that I found a way to be engaged in the in activism. Now, sometimes part of my activism was in the circumstances of writing reports or trying to raise money, but I was never content to just provide support and not be engaged. I used to work for a dynamic organization here in Philadelphia, some of you know, Crisis Intervention Network, that worked in the city. In fact, to me, it was, I've never seen an organization that dynamic in Philadelphia during my lifetime. And even there, my job was administrative, but like I was always engaged with people, I guess we'll call them field staff, who were working directly in the neighborhoods that, like, I just had that motivation. Years ago, when I was started working with the American Friends Service Committee, again, my job was a very highfalutin title without even going into it. But what wound up doing was organizing workers in places like Monroe, Louisiana, Shreveport, Louisiana, Tyler, Texas, Pine Bluff, Arkansas, so that, and I mean like knocking on doors, going to churches and things like that, so that that's just my own personal proclivity, I guess, is to be engaged on the ground.
And I just want to add, you know, one of the things that fascinates me about the those who were able to survive the movement of the 60s, who were inspired of that time period, and kept going is sort of how do you move from that moment where it seems like revolution is on the horizon, right? Where we're sort of on the precipice of a new and better and different world, and then to find out that you're not, right? That in fact, like, you know, we win some major victories, but also there are a lot of shifts that you know, in some things, in some ways make things worse, in some ways just, you know, the changes that you want to see don't happen. And so one of the things that I really wanted to address in the book is how do you keep going, right? And I think this is part of where, you know, the nonprofit system emerges, you know, for good and bad reasons. But I think there are a lot of people, including but not just Michael and Zahara, who went to groups like the AFSC to try and continue that work, right? Because here was a progressive social justice organization that open their doors, you know, sometimes more widely than others, to people that had that organizing experience, right? But it raises a whole set of other questions of how you negotiate the process of making change, right? You're salaried. These organizations are trying to, you know, reproduce themselves and make sure that they endure in ways that, you know, more radical groups don't have that same kind of motivation. So I think that question was really, you know, hovering for me a lot in this book.
And one thing, too, I do just want to say, too, we should name, too, that in that transition period in the 70s, like, we have to name state violence that played a part in moving a lot of social activists and street activists who were part of the Black Liberation Movement into the nonprofit space, because literally they were being killed, they were being falsely imprisoned, they were being run into exile, they were under siege. Essentially, it was counterinsurgency. Their own government had declared war on them. And so I could see how going to work for a nonprofit that was doing organizing work could be, just from a self-preservation standpoint, a safer option after watching so many activists, you know, be murdered, be falsely imprisoned as well. So I think that also is something that played into the, in, as well, just a survivor mechanism.
If I could, though, the one impression I don't want to leave is that that activism is not determined by employment. Mm-hmm. So I may not have had the resources to do some of the things that I had done, but if I had been working in a factory, I would have been an activist. If I had been working, digging a ditch, I used to drive a cab for about 3 years here in Philly, and I was trying to organize my fellow cab drivers. So I don't want people.
Absolutely.
Zahar and I were fortunate to be in an employment situation where we could pay the rent and go live out the our beliefs. But it's important that wherever you are at, you should be an activist. As I tell people that, you know, when young people I've spoken to over the years say, well, what can I do? You know, where should I start? And I always say, start where you're at. Wherever you are, in your school, in your community, in your church, somebody's getting jerked around that ain't supposed to be getting jerked around. And you work your way out. I mean, I didn't start out thinking about South Africa. I didn't start out thinking about Palestine. You know, I was thinking about some dynamics at Temple, some dynamics in my neighborhood. And things took me places. So that I just think that we should not make it too expansive. If you just do your part. And you never know what's going to spark it. Because I like to tell people, if you think about the Black Like Me movement, the contemporary Black liberation, and if someone had been stepping back, say, 10, 15 years ago, he's saying, where might it start? Well, you say, well, probably Philly, Chicago, New York. But who ever heard of Ferguson?
Right.
And that's the point that I want to make, is that nobody knows where that spark is. All we can do is to do work where we're at to see if it may be there, and if the spark is somewhere else, to link up to it. But like, we can't solve it all at once. It's going to take time. So let's do what we need to do where we're at.
Michael, I'd like to ask, two-part question, but let me get the first one first. What was your thinking that led to your joining the Nation of Islam, and what was your experience there? And part two, do you have any comments on your activism and work with the Black Student League at Temple University?
One, I was there very brief, I mean months, we're talking about, not years. And frankly, for me, to some degree, it was a result of having left the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee and looking for some organizational framework to express my ideas. When it comes to religion, I'm just about a heretic. I mean, which is not to, that I respect people's religious traditions. You know, I will take off my shoes, I won't eat pork, I won't eat beef, whatever you do, I'll do. So don't misunderstand me. But on the other hand, that was not me, to be honest with you. And that, like, the level of activism, or lack of activism, as I perceive activism, was what did not allow me to do the kind of work that I wanted to do, which is why I did not stay there long. But the experience was an experience that I will value and treasure and learn some things in terms of being passed. Because I tend to say I passed through the Nation rather than I was in the Nation, to be honest with you. Yeah. Gosh, that's a long story. The Black Student League at Temple. I mean, that I like to say, in fact, some of the people in the room here were both my colleagues and mentors in terms of organizing what is now the Black Studies program at Temple University, that one of the significant things we did that I think from an organizing approach was we were able to unite the Black student organizations in one organization called the Steering Committee for Black Students, so that it involved every Black organization on campus. And we were able to engage people at various levels of work, because some people just are not going to do the things I'm going to do, but they went to school to become a doctor. So we say then mentor this student who's studying biology. That's all you have to do. You don't even have to do anything else, but just mentor that student. That's part of the struggle as far as we were concerned. We were able to develop a communications one, what we call our theoretical journal, Maji Maji, based on a struggle in Kenya during their independence days, the name of it, and the Black Torch, which was a community newspaper. And we tried to stop, I know I didn't, had no idea the forces that be that we now call gentrification, but we tried to stop the expansion of Temple University into North Philadelphia, and at best, we may have slowed it down a little, because they won that one, but winning that one, I should put it that way. But nevertheless, that what the experience of that Temple showed me again was Black power in action, because when people say what's Black, it is you determining what you can do, what is possible. And that I tell people, well, when you start a social movement, and like I saw this in South Dakota years ago, working with the Native American movement, that things come to the fore that you had no idea were there. Resources, people who you ignored become leaders, people who find a space for themselves. In jail, when I was doing my days up at Allenwood in Lewisburg, that I was able to write a play that was so good, and was good because of the people in the play, not the play, that they allowed us to go to Bucknell University to perform the play. And for many of the people who went, it was the first time they had ever seen a college campus, ever stepped on a college campus. And that we had people who were developing sets, painting, who were directing, who were producing. And these are people who, in some cases, barely get out of junior high school. Because I tell folks, education is a function of opportunity. But don't tell me because of limited education that it compromises your intellect. Because I saw many, many folks who had no formal education write novels and legal briefs and whatnot in jail. So that I just think that the social movements turn things upside down and inside out for people that I think is positive.
Dan, what was it like writing a book during a pandemic? The process in a short snapshot. And also, Michael, what are you doing now? I know as long as there's breath in you, you're still an activist and you're still doing the work. So I like people to understand what work you're doing now.
Thanks for that question. I also just want to say, when people are asking, Michael for some of these reflections on some of the organizations he was a part of, that it's all in the book. So I wanted to just be sure to make that clear as well. Michael was when. Started the book, Mike was in Budapest, Zahara was in Florida. So I feel proud to be an early adopter of Zoom pre-pandemic to do some of our interviews. But during the pandemic itself, I had hoped to go to Europe to visit some archives and do some interviews out there. There was a lot of archival research that really shifted for me, and then or just wasn't possible. I did both more and different interviews than I had planned, but also I am a parent, and the my son was in kindergarten when the pandemic started, and like kindergarten first year was the worst year of my entire life. And so it's, that's there in the book, right? I mean, you know, for me, that's there. Both because it was you know, this is the hardest book that I've had to do, just because the world was collapsing. And to me, the book was a source. The book was always a source of hope and optimism. To have this opportunity to engage with friends and sort of beloved elders, and to be able to sort of tell their story together, and sort of, but that's not just their story, but is about this sort of ongoing commitment. And then also to write it, you know, as a parent, and thinking about the kind of world my kid is growing up in, and kids are growing up in, and what sort of world that they. What I want for them, right? And hope the sacrifices that they shouldn't have to make, but the world that they have to live in.
With me, since the pandemic, and then we were living with my son in Atlanta, and moving back to Philly, then having to go back to Budapest to move out, that my life has been in total disruption. In fact, the book is one of the stabilizing aspects of my life right now. But the one thing, though, that my wife and I helped to start a refugee organization in Hungary, the initiative came from a Sierra Leone, the refugee in Hungary, and it started 9 years ago. It was called MIG Help, the convergence of words, and now it's called Next Step. But and so that is the most political work, and my wife and I spent time in Hungary this year working with refugees from the Ukraine. The stable group of refugees that come in are from the third world, Africa and the Middle East primarily, although Asia also. But because of the war in Ukraine, I've had to incorporate those refugees into the work so that, without going into the politics of Hungary, just think of as Trump light in terms of the politics, so that the work we do is surreptitious. We can't publicize it. We have to do it without the government. I'm sure the government knows about it, but we try not to publicly embarrass the government, which causes me pain. Some years ago, over there, like I tell people, there's a lot of African Americans in the U.S. with good deep voice, but in Budapest, I'm the man. I mean, so that since 2008, I've had a radio show that I play old school rhythm and blues, talk about the Chitlin Circuit, and I used to do a lot of talking, music and human rights, African American music, by the way. Popular music is just littered with progressive ideas and themes and whatnot, and I've use that. But again, because of the political climate in Hungary, I've had to back away from the politics, but we still mail in the show every 2 weeks. It's called Soul School, and you can listen to it if you want to find out about how to hear it. Going back to the beginning days, my wife is the technical assistant. We call her DJ Wonder Woman, and I'm the professor. So that sums it up for now. But I do hope, though, because I was talking, Dan and I spoke at Temple University today at a class, and I am really looking forward to engaging some of these young minds out here who are doing all sorts of creative, intellectual things that I never even thought about.
A round of applause.
Thank you, Dan and Michael. This has been, you know, very informative. I would encourage everyone to read this book, for real. This joint is going to have you up. I picked it up. I didn't put it down. So thank you for sharing this history with us.
Just one thing. I just want to mention that my daughter, Aisha Shahida Simmons, and my son, Tyree Simmons, are here, and I just like to acknowledge them. I don't want to embarrass either one, but I have to say my daughter is an award-winning documentary filmmaker, Tyree is known as DJ Drama. So
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.